Tommy Fugeret.
Good morning and welcome to Shattering This. I am your host, Yada. This is the program where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and with politics, military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news this morning, I'm going to try to explain why these things have happened and what it means to you and me. In our second hour, we're going to turn our attention to Yahweh, to His Torah, and to His covenant so that we come to understand its terms and conditions as well as its benefits. Our number, should you want to engage in this conversation, if you wish to question or criticize, even affirm anything that I have to say today, our number is 877-300-7645. And for those just looking for verification of the evidence behind the conclusions that will be presented today and every day on this program, you can go to intro2god.org, yadaya.com, prophetofdoom.net. Now on to the news. Talk of reining in America's gun culture, we are told, is considered politically risky for Obama, which would mean that it is something that he typically would like to avoid and that he doesn't want to take any political risk. He is a political animal. After all, politics is all that man has ever known. He has never engaged a single day of his life earning an honest living in business. But locked in a talk race against Republican challenger Mitt Romney, he couldn't help himself, and this is what he said yesterday. All of us recognize that these kinds of terrible, tragic events, now he's talking about what happened with the six deaths in Wisconsin, are happening with much too regularity for us not to do some soul searching to examine additional ways that we can reduce violence, Obama said in an Oval Office ceremony to sign an unrelated bill. Here is the reality. The number of gun deaths in America, a nation of 300 million people, is not alarming. If you wanted to do something that diminished violence marketably in America, particularly gun violence in America, the thing that you would do is you would legalize drugs. The moment you legalize drugs, you would reduce the amount of gun-related fatalities by in the range of about 60 or 70%. If you were to say, you know, we don't want anybody having guns that we think might be hateful or racist, disagree with us, and that's the approach, of course, Obama would like to take, your reduction in the number of those killed by guns would be so infinitesimal it could not be calculated. The vast preponderance of gun deaths in America are due to the fact that the U.S. government is fighting an idiotic war against a choice. If someone wants to medicate, if they wish to drink, if they wish to take drugs, whatever someone does in the privacy of their home ought to be their choice. Taking drugs is stupid. Medicating your body with poisons is absolutely foolish. But so is religion. So is politics. So is joining the U.S. military. All of those things are foolish. And yet we give people the right to do them. Since smoking is stupid, and we make that legal, why are we fighting a war, allegedly, against something that we have declared to be illegal that is really no different than those compounds? Combination of cigarettes and alcohol, and you have most drugs. Now, there's plenty of rules on the books to deal with issues related to someone using drugs while driving a car or operating a piece of equipment that endangers the lives of others. Those remain. But what people do in terms of buying and selling drugs ought to be legal. And if we did that, we would hugely reduce the gun-related deaths in this country. Also, if you want to do some soul-searching, Mr. President, the thing that you ought to consider is, what is it that motivates people to kill? And almost universally, it is a political scheme, a religious scheme, or a racial scheme that is derived from a political or religious scheme. And so there is a way to deal with that as well, and it has nothing to do with violating the U.S. Constitution. It has all to do with shedding one's ignorance, with becoming rational, and with having a open and bold discussion about the corruptive nature of religion and politics and what it does to people. White House spokesman Jay Carney reiterated, however, that Obama, I don't know why there's a however here, but nonetheless there is, that Obama remained in favor of renewing an assault weapons ban, but pointed out there has been reluctance by Congress to pass it. Yeah, it's unconstitutional. The U.S. Constitution particularly foresaw the use of weapons that would be used against the government. The constitutional right to bear arms has nothing to do with hunting. It has nothing to do with recreational shooting. It has nothing to do with self-defense. Absolutely nothing. The constitutional right to bear arms is designed to oppose government oppression. It is designed to prevent what we have today with the U.S. military being larger than the rest of the world's militaries combined. It turns our presidents into dictators. It usurps our freedoms. That is what the founding fathers of this country were trying to avoid. And yet, this president wants to deny the Constitution once again and pass a ban on the ability of Americans to own these kinds of weapons. Of course, this assault on the Sikh community was a 9mm handgun. That is not an assault weapon. Obama said the FBI was still investigating the Temple shooting, but if it turned out to be ethnically motivated, the American people would, quote, immediately recoil. Of course it's ethnically motivated. The guy was a white supremacist. He was a racist. You know, there is one passage that some friends of mine sent me an email after yesterday's show when I was talking about how if your view of the world is racial, you're lost. And that would include the conspiracy theorists who look for Jews behind every corner and blame them for all of the world's ills. That would include neo-Nazis like this guy. That would include Muslims whose Quran is more anti-Semitic than Hitler's Mein Kampf. That would include those in the African American and Hispanic community that are racist. It would include anyone who views the world from the perspective of race. There is a story that is really interesting in the Torah about this. Yahweh, as we know, picked a reluctant scribe named Moshe to scribe his Torah. And Aaron, who was the more articulate of the brothers, was engaged to speak at times for Moshe because Moshe had a stammer. And Miriam, another player in this family setting, decided that when Moshe wanted to marry a Cushite woman, which means that she would be African and therefore black, and therefore not Hebrew, that when he wanted to marry her, that she thought that now she and Aaron were somehow superior to Moshe, and that they could usurp his authority to speak for God, based upon the racial indiscretion of Moshe deciding that, you know, I'm going to marry because I love her, because she and I are in love. I'm going to marry a black woman. And so what God's response was? And God didn't side with the racial argument of, you know, Moshe, you're a Hebrew. You ought not be doing that. But he did. He turned Miriam white. Pure, absolute white, but not in a good way. He gave her leprosy. He says, why don't you go and have a time out, Miriam? And maybe when you get your act together, you can come back in and join the family. But between now and then, you think white power, white is so much better than black? Here, try out some leprosy. Go hang out on your own for a while. Have a time out and think about it. God's not God's view of the world has nothing to do with skin color, and yours should not either. The final quote from the Condescender-in-Chief of the United States reads, it would be very important for us to reaffirm once again that this country, regardless of what we may look like, where we come from, who we worship, we are all one people, he said. Utter rubbish. I don't worship anyone. I don't worship any God, nor should you. And it does matter what God you think is God. The God created by Christianity, the God created by Rabbinic Judaism, the God created by Islam, the God created by the guru in the 15th century for the sheikhs, the God created by Joseph Smith. They have nothing in common. It does matter. They are different. And while it makes no difference if my skin is the more olive color of the Sioux Indians because I'm Sioux, or you are of European heritage or African heritage or Hispanic, it makes no difference relative to skin color. But what you believe, what you know, your foundational principles from which you view life, whether they are from the perspective of the Torah or from the perspective of some beguiling religion or political scheme, it does make a difference. This idea that we all should coexist and that we all are one, even in fact that most people have diametrically opposed political and religious stances, is one of the great myths of multiculturalism. There was a protest not long ago at the University of Virginia where the placards read, we are intolerant of intolerance. It is pure hypocrisy to hold this view. Well, that's the end of our first segment of Shattering Myths this morning. We're going to return speaking about Afghanistan. I hope you'll be with us. This is Shattering Myths. Welcome to the program. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm going to go back on a promise now. During the last segment, I said I was going to move on to Afghanistan. I'm not. My producer and I, Scott, had a discussion during the break, and so we're going to stay on this same theme if it's all right with all of you. Since Scott controls this program, it's all right with him, so I guess it's going to be all right with all of us. The comment that he made is, isn't it a bit odd that that these two gun issues would occur on the eve of the U.S. consideration of the U.N. Weapons treaty that would restrict ownership and the trade of weapons. And I said, it is unfortunate, and we've talked about this before, it is unfortunate that they are occurring at the same time. It isn't odd that they are occurring at the same time. And I understand that the Genesis Communication Network hosts a number of extraordinarily articulate conspiracy theorists, and what I say now may be opposed to what they are conveying, but here's the reality. The United States does conspire. There's no question that the United States government does conspire. And there are cases, many of them each year, where the FBI will take a fundamentalist Muslim who they've, you know, read, you know, spied on their emails. They said, okay, this is the fundamentalist Muslim with a tendency to be a jihadist. And they will go to that fundamentalist Muslim, pretend to be Muslims, and then say, hey, let's go and plan an attack on some infidels. And then they will equip that Muslim with a suit suicide pact that will be dysfunctional. They will equip that Muslim with a gun that will be dysfunctional, and then they will arrange that Muslim to go and attack a particular place at a particular time, and when they do, they will arrest them. And so, you know, that kind of a sting operation, which I find repulsive, is perpetrated all the time. But the difference is that the weapons are always dysfunctional. And the plan is always thwarted to make the FBI look like, hey, we caught another bad guy. The idea that the FBI is going to intervene and make certain that not only do these nutcases have weapons, but help them target their crime scene and conspire with them to motivate the Joker and the skinhead to go off and randomly kill people so that the government can sign another imposition against the U.S. Constitution on guns is just not rational. Yeah, you're dealing with a group of people in the case of the Joker where even the psychiatrist weeks before the incident went to the campus police and said, I've got a idiot on my hands. We have a problem. That Joker is not an arm of the U.S. government. Now, I know that a lot of times conspiracies grow out of government dishonesty and incompetence. 9/11 is a great example. There are lots of people who think that 9/11 was an inside job. That's not true. It's absolutely not true. It's an irrational conclusion. But the U.S. government has made it susceptible to those kinds of conspiracies because, A, it had the evidence that I've shared with you, that Ramzi Youssef designed and published the plan for 9/11 many years before it happened, and that it was revealed in a Philippine court, and Ramzi Youssef is a prisoner in the United States. The United States knew that it was going to happen. It knew how it was going to happen, and it did not stop it. So you're susceptible at that point to conspiracy theorists. Also, anybody with their right mind knows that Al-Qaeda had very little to nothing to do with 9/11. And this notion that the U.S. government can spend $4 trillion, invade two countries, bomb many others, kill thousands of peoples with drones, all because we're at war with Al-Qaeda, which is a terrorist club that we ourselves created, is such an egregious lie that people want to fill the gaps with, well, that's not true, so what is true? And so I want to clear the decks here and say it's important that we understand the evidence. It's important that we understand the connections between these things. It is unfortunate timing with the treaty, but the United States government had absolutely nothing to do with either of these two morons. They were both motivated by mythology, and both of them lost touch with reality. Now, returning to the story I promised we'd cover, which is Afghanistan. One of the problems in Afghanistan is the same problem we had in Vietnam. In fact, when we invaded Afghanistan, before we invaded Afghanistan, I publicly declared and wrote that Afghanistan would be another Vietnam for America, and the parallels, we could go on and do 10 programs on the parallels of how that turned out to be, that prophecy turned out to be true. But in one of these cases, we have the reality that Afghan policemen, the very people we're training and arming, are continuing to defect to the Taliban, taking their weapons and equipment with them. So we'll return briefly to that story after the break. This is Shattering Myths. Our number, should you wish to engage in the conversation, 877-300-7645. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Our number, 877-300-7645. And again, should you wish to have the evidence behind the positions and perspective being presented in this show, I'd encourage you to go to yadaya.com. Well, yesterday, 11 Afghan policemen defected to the Taliban in the southern province of Helmand. The men switched sides early in the morning, taking all of their weapons and equipment with them. It is the second such defection in recent weeks, police commander said. The reality here is that we are arming our enemy in Afghanistan. We are literally providing the weapons that they are using against us. And the majority of U.S. deaths now in Afghanistan aren't attributable to improvised explosive devices, but are in fact attributable to the Afghan army that we have trained, put in fancy uniforms, and given nice weapons, them deploying those weapons against us. It is shades of Vietnam all over again. This is a situation that in which we cannot prevail. There's a story that came out yesterday that I haven't fully studied, but it said that the United States is trying to sweeten its terms, improve its terms on a prisoner release for the Taliban. This is, you know, how we got into the mucky waters in Vietnam, where we had prisoners of war we wanted released. We wanted to get out of Vietnam. And so Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger created peace with honor, remember, and we got our prisoners back in a prisoner exchange. And the North Vietnamese communists said, okay, and we'll leave South Vietnam alone. You know, we'll have an armistice. We won't go in there. And the reality is that the sense of honor that is derived from a Judeo-Christian culture that has some understanding of the instruction that Yah etched in stone, where he said you should not consistently bear false witness. The antithesis of that exists in communism. They're guided by Machiavellian principles where the end justifies the means. There is no incentive not to lie. So these North Vietnamese, the communists, simply took over the South within months of the time that we retreated. It was as if we had never been there, except we lost 65,000 Americans and squandered billions of dollars. The same thing's true with Afghanistan. You can, in Islam, lying is considered good. It's not considered bad. And so, with the Taliban, who are fundamentalist Muslims, who know Muhammad's example at Huda Bayah, you can negotiate all day long with them for whatever you wish to negotiate, and they will take whatever you're going to give them, but whatever they promise to do in return will be absolutely worthless. It's just like this idea that people think that the Jews in Israel should negotiate with the Muslims and therefore give them a state. Well, they'll take whatever they're given, but their promises for peace, their promises to let the rest of Israel alone will be absolutely worthless. And so the U.S. government is only creating an enemy in Afghanistan. It is not eliminating one. That was a lose-lose proposition when we went in. It cannot be won. It cannot be rectified. It is foolish to continue to allow people to die for a cause that cannot prevail. Leave. This is a really interesting story. Iran's security chief yesterday told in a press conference that was televised, told President Bashar al-Assad, it was the first time that he was even photographed in 3 weeks, that Syria is part of a vital regional alliance that Tehran will not allow to be broken. During talks in Damascus, Saeed Jalali said that Syria was an essential part of, quote, an axis of resistance. Now, what's interesting here is what comprises the axis of resistance. Now, we know that Syria is a client of Iran. And Syria became a client of Iran when the United States stupidly, suicidally, went into Iraq and deposed Saddam Hussein, who was an enemy of Iran. And when we said, oh, democracy is a really cool thing, we're going to allow democracy in Iraq, and 65% of the people were Sunni, were Shia Muslims, and the Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani and the Sattar said, who were both Iranian Muslims, told all of their imams, you tell the people that they either vote for the Shiite representative that we are going to put up, or Allah will toast their britches in hell. And they did. And so we gave, thereby, Iraq to Iran. And when we did, not only did Iran get their former enemy wrapped up in a beautiful present by the United States, well equipped now with weapons that Iran will use, we also gave Iran Syria. Fundamentally changed the balance of the power in the Islamic world, and for the worst, because there is no country in the Islamic world more fundamentalist Islamic than Iran. So since that time, you've had now an axis that Iran controls. Now, when the United States State Department and its military heard the axis of resistance, they knew precisely who the Syed Jalili was talking about. The media here would say, oh, but it included, Hezbollah and it includes, Hamas. That's what he's talking about. It's Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, and Hamas. That's like the United States with Iran and Hezbollah. With the United States saying, we have an axis that is our international axis of resistance that we won't allow to be severed, and it includes the United States, the U.S. Army, the U.S. Air Force, and the U.S. Marine Corps. Say what? Hezbollah is the equivalent with Iran as the U.S. Marines are with the United States. So that's not their axis. Hamas, about 3 months ago, when the Shiite-led government in Syria had passed the 10,000 point in the number of Sunni Muslims they had murdered and were climbing up to 20,000, Hamas, which is a resolutely Sunni terrorist organization, publicly declared that they were on the side of the rebels, the Sunni rebels in Syria, and that they were opposed to the Shiite government. So to say that the axis that shall not be broken includes Hamas is to be wholly ignorant of Sunni versus Shia Islam and of the statements made by Hamas. The axis that Iran was speaking is Iran, Iraq, and Syria. And that is what America created by its stupid invasion of Iraq. We gave Iraq to Iran. And now this axis of resistance is now Iran, Iraq, and Syria. Now, the reason that that is important is because then now you understand who the foes are. Who is battling here? What's at stake? What you have is Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, as well as the personal little fiefdoms that emerged out of the United Arab Emirates, Qatar and Bahrain and the like, having their warlords supply weapons to the Sunni Mujahideen, who, by the way, are the exact same people from the exact same clubs that are planting suicide bombs in Iraq, blowing hundreds of people up. Well, they're arming them now in Syria so that they can oppose the Syrian military, because the Sauds and the Kuwaitis and the other Sunni Muslim influences don't like this shift of power that made Iran more powerful than they are. And they realize that if they can disassociate Syria from Iran, that Sunni Islam will regain its dominance in power over Shia Islam. And that is what is at stake here. It is a fascinating portrayal of religious infighting, and what's going to happen in the short term is somewhat difficult to predict, but here are some thoughts. You've got now Russia having engaged on behalf of Iran and therefore the Alawite government. You have the United States having made a public declaration that it's sending weapons to the Sunnis, which makes Iran and Saudi Arabia not only enemies, but now Russia and the United States are on the opposite side of this battle. China will also join with Russia, because China has a vital interest in Iran because of the Caspian Sea oil reserves. And so you're going to have a proxy war now with the United States and Europe fighting and providing weapons on one side, and Russia and China providing weapons on the other. That is a unbelievable mess. And while we're doing all of this, we have to recognize, okay, what is that kind of a proxy war going to lead to? What is it when we're done with it? What happens when the United States and Europe are now at war with China and Russia because they're supplying arms on the other side? What happens when Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Qatar and Bahrain are at war against Iran and Iraq? And so by ignoring what is actually happening here and who the forces are, the United States has foolishly engaged in this conflict. And there is no good that can come out of this. You know, the opening news before this program began this morning was talking about the free Syrian rebels as if they are freedom fighters. That's utter nonsense. As bad as Assad is, the fundamentalist Mujahideen that are fighting him, empowered, will be worse. That does not mean that we should be backing Assad. We shouldn't. But it means we also shouldn't be backing the jihadists, the Mujahideen, that are fighting him. No good can come out of this, and it only gets worse when the United States becomes a player and supplies arms through the CIA, which we are doing now. We've engaged ourselves in a murderous civil war. And we created this axis of resistance because we gave Iran, Iraq. Stupid in the extreme. This is Shattering Myths. I hope you'll join the conversation after the break. Our number is 877-300-7645. You can also are invited to go to yadaya.com.
Today.
Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're completing the first of our 2 hours of Shattering Myths. During the break, Scott, my producer, and I were talking about what the consequence was of this particular war. And one of the things that Scott said, and correctly so, was that, you know, this is like welcome back to the Cold War Part Deux. You know, we're repeating the same thing that we did in the Cold War. And while that is astute, and it is Russia against the United States, and to some extent Europe, in this case, though, against China, it isn't quite that clear-cut. You see, in the Cold War, by building these enormous militaries and by the United States and the Soviet Union picking thugs in various countries and backing our preferred thug with weapons and with money and letting those thugs battle it out for control of the countries, that when the Soviet Union went bankrupt, and the United States went bankrupt too, but we created the illusion that we're not bankrupt by continuing to destroy the value of our currency. But when the parties essentially went bankrupt and stopped funding and arming the various combatants, the Cold War simply fizzled out, and it was gone. This will not be the case this time. It's not going to be the case this time for two reasons. The first is that the proxy war that is now being fought is between religious zealots. These are Sunni and Shia Muslims. They are the most religiously devout Muslims in the world. They will continue to war against each other. Nothing will stop it. This is a battle that we have ignited that nothing on earth can extinguish. Now, let's speak specifically about where this is going to go, because it's important that you know how what's happening in Syria and what's happening across the Islamic world is going to affect you and your family. There is more prophetic ink devoted to this than almost any topic that Yah speaks about prophetically. And what he has said very clearly is that this is going to erupt into a worldwide war, that the Muslims are going to attack Israel in unison, and that the rest of the world is going to engage in a war based upon that. And he specifically talks about how, as a consequence of that war in the first phase, that one out of every four people on Earth is going to die. And in the second phase, a third of those remaining are going to die. That's half the population of this globe. At this point, that would be 3.5 billion people are going to be affected by what we have kindled in Syria and what is happening in the Islamic world. One half of the world's population. Also, during this war, we are told that one third of the Earth will become uninhabitable. This is because of the United States and Russia being opposed to one another, becoming enemies again because of what is now happening in Iran, Iraq, and Syria. And it's going to be a nuclear exchange. It is quite easy, actually. When one has an open mind, you're not blinded by religion and politics, to put together the timetable that Yah has presented for us. So I can tell you with a great deal of assurance that this skirmish that we're seeing, which is killing tens of thousands of people, and will ultimately lead to killing hundreds of thousands of people and then billions of people, is going to erupt on the world stage in 2027. And it's going to come to a close. This phase of the war is going, world war, will come to a close in 2029. That's how much time you have left. The end of the world as we know it, beginning of a world as I know it, will commence in 2033. In future programs, I will tell you what's going to happen in 2033 and how I have come to know that that is the time. And it's not because of any personal insight. All I did was observe the evidence and think about it, something that we're going to do as part of this program. But it is very important that you know that there is a very serious consequence of your government's malfeasance in Syria. And when the U.S. government and this administration decided that we would arm the rebels through the CIA in Turkey to oppose the Assad regime, that we made one of the most costly blunders in American history. And that's hard for me to say, recognizing how unbelievably costly the blunder we made by invading Afghanistan and Iraq and squandering $4 trillion and leading to the deaths of 900,000 people. Our involvement in Syria will be more costly still. This is Shattering Myths. I encourage you to come back after the hour, where we're going to discuss Yah's Torah teaching. Our number, 877-300-7645. Please engage in this conversation.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give